listening to Wine on the Vine with Lisa Mayaka, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Happy Thursday to everyone and welcome back. I am your host for the next hour of Shameless Storytelling. My name is Lisa Mayaka and you are most welcome. Thank you so much to those of you who have tuned in to our first month. I am celebrating four shows. We have been heard all across the United States, as well as in several countries abroad, including profoundly Colombia, a couple of weeks ago when we had a guest that hailed from a village there. And it's just so gratifying and wonderful to hear voices from near and far validating this format. We are a storytelling show. This show is all about you and your story. This is not therapy. This is not how-to. As much as I'd love it to be, this is not a wine, W-I-N-E, show. This is a wine, W-H-I-N-E, On the Vine show. And I am not only your host this week, but I am also the sponsor. So Wine on the Vine can be found on wineonthevine.com, Wine on the Vine Facebook page, where we are airing live right now, and we'll continue to have today's show available to you hitherto, hereafter, I don't know, maybe forevermore. I don't know how that social media stuff works yet, but we're figuring it out. But we are also coming to you with a couple of very wonderful moments to celebrate this week and this month. So this is known as Women's History Month. Among other things, I am celebrating Social Worker Month because that is my profession of training. But it is Women's History Month. And as a woman with a history, I have a guest coming on shortly who is not just an extraordinary woman, but she has so many angles of lived experience and history. And so I know 50 minutes is not going to be enough to get into all of that. But what we do have to offer you today, I hope will meet you where you are. Because my belief is that you may not know the names of my guests, but you will find yourself somewhere in their stories. And so before I bring Laura on to kind of handle this hour for us, I want to give another shout out to a wonderful woman who has supplied me today with this gorgeous handmade jewelry, Fused Glass by Rita Lucero, and it is New Mexican, handmade. You can find a little blurbage on my Wine on the Vine Facebook page. And she's tickled to have, you know, the celebrity from LA wearing her stuff. But I'm the blessed one today to have this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous jewelry to put on for you that are watching by video. For those of you listening to us on the air, audio, while you're traveling in traffic or what have you, welcome, welcome, welcome. I have often wondered what it might be like to tell my story out loud to an audience that I didn't know. And I think it's not an easy thing. There is bravery and vulnerability and courage involved. One of my favorite authors and current pontificators, John Acuff, says this: everyone has a story. When we don't take the time to know someone's story, or worse, we create our own version of their story, we lose the chance and the opportunity to understand what they need and for us have that first step toward empathy. And I don't know any greater need in our world today than for we humans to grow in our capacity for empathy. So in that vein, let me ask y'all a question. What's your favorite four-letter F word? Just throwing it out there. Y'all can reply on Facebook. You can phone, but I don't know that I'll pick it up. I'm driving to the gym the other morning at 4:45 a.m. because that's a thing. Private gym, you know, masks and limited population, all that. But it's dark in Southern California at 4:45 a.m. And I pull up to a stoplight and the only light that I can see, like the sun hasn't even woken up yet. And I'm wondering, what are you doing, woman? This is dumb. But I look to my right and from this like dive corner liquor store is this flashing neon light that says cigars and fine wine. And all my brain has to offer back is define fine. And that, my friends, is not only the name of my blog this week, which you can find on wineonthevine.com, but it's also the first question I'm going to ask my guest. So will you please welcome to the show today, Miss Laura.
Hello. Oh my God.
Hi.
Hello, everybody. Wow. I loved how you began that. How fun was that?
How are you?
I'm good. I'm fine. I'm fine.
So what does that mean?
Well, you know,
Define fine.
Well, you know, before I define fine for you, I love how you opened it. You know, it reminded me one of my favorite things, which is, I don't even know who said it, but
If we never know our struggle, we'll never know. Okay, that's a little deep.
I love that.
All right. We'll never know our strength.
Yeah, we never know our struggle. So
I have invited you here to tell me your story,
which
I know encompasses so much struggle, which also, since you just said that, helps me understand why you are perceived, and I believe you to be so strong.
Mm.
But how are you?
Fine.
And what does fine mean?
Well, the fine you wanted me to clarify.
Please.
And you did ask me to share your favorite swear word. And so
your favorite four-letter F word.
Okay. So I'm going to define the fine from my 12-step program.
Okay.
Which you asked me to do.
I did.
Which how we define fine is fucked, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. So excuse that if I made any of you sweat.
I'm not sweating. I'm going,
but, you know,
tell me more.
Oh like, my gosh.
Hello. Why have I never understood that this is what fine means?
Well, that's why in my program, we're not allowed to say fine because usually, you know, we're not. And, that's why.
But why do you, why does anyone, that's my ask in this week's blog. I say, you know, when I called a friend who recently had a liver transplant,
right,
and it saved his life and his recovery is pretty ginormous. Mm-hmm. There's a lot involved and, on any given day, fatigue and fever and other things set in, but he's alive and he's going to be that way for a while. But when I said, how's recovery going? Mm-hmm. And he says, fine, how are you? And I say, well, I'm fine too. Mm-hmm. Like, those don't mean the same thing.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's so funny because when we were talking about this earlier, and we looked up, why do people say I'm fine?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of time it's to be polite because they won't be able to handle what the answer actually is.
So you can't handle the truth.
Right. You can't handle the truth. And, you know, also imagine the depths of the life and death experience of that. And perhaps he wouldn't even know how to tell you what's actually going on with him. That's why I think when we go through something like that, or when we go through anything that's out of a normal life experience, it's truly important to reach out to a support group that's walked in your shoes. I mean, in your opening, you used the word empathy, and empathy means that you've walked in someone's shoes. I mean, that's literally what that word means.
And that is the reason for this show. Mm. You're totally setting up the whole like shameless storytelling. Like this is to have a plethora of guests from all walks of life tell us their stories. Mm-hmm. So, Laura, You're the star today.
Uh-oh.
You're the most powerful person in the room. What's your story?
Well, first of all, let's define shame because we're talking about shameless.
That's the name of my show.
I love it. I love it. Well, you know, guilt and shame, they're two different words. You know, guilt is I've done something wrong, but shame is I'm wrong. There's something wrong with me. And I grew up with the perfect childhood that would set me up to be a shame-based person. Something wrong with me.
So wait, because I've heard a little bit of your story. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You were raised in the OC. Mm-hmm. Y'all had a boat. Y'all had money.
Yep.
Y'all looked party.
Yep. Big Bear cabin.
Mom and dad married.
6-carat diamond ring on my mama. Lots of fancy clothes.
Private school, public school?
Public.
Public school.
But good schools.
Good schools.
Yeah.
And so, I'm sorry, but let's back. Like, what wasn't okay about that?
Well, you know.
Where's the guilt and shame?
Yeah. Well, I am textbook child of, you know, of a family in the 70s and, you know, 60s of child of an alcoholic. And the child of an alcoholic that also had a temper and a little girl that was hit. And, you know, I have a really weird and unusual, but kind of cool story in that I am an identical mirror image twin. So when you look at me, in other words, when I'm looking at my twin, it's like looking in the mirror. So there was ongoing unbelievably bad stress every day as a child.
Okay, so that's an adult version of what happened to you as a kid. Mm-hmm. When you were a kid, tell me what that looked like. Because I don't, you know, that could be, yeah. I could tell you that I had an unbelievable amount of stress yesterday.
Yeah, right.
And it was, right. The mail came and I got a bill from the IRS. And right. You'd look at that and go, that's not really stressful to me.
Right.
So what did that look like?
You know, what that looked like was you never knew what today was going to be like. And I was, you know, the sensitive child, like that was established from super duper early on. And, you know, there was mental health problems in previous generations in our family. So that left my brain open to not working functionally. And so it was that along with what was going on that left me unable to cope with what was happening.
All right, so time out.
Uh-oh.
You sound like I do when I wax clinical.
Oh, God.
What was going on?
What was going on was lots of hitting, lots of screaming, lots of...
Parents to children.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had like a nervous breakdown at 8. And
8 years old?
8 years old. And I'll never forget it. I was watching the movie with the red shoes.
Dorothy.
Yeah.
The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
This is incredulous that I know the answer to this because I was
raised
without TV.
It was so stressful.
But there's red shoes involved. Yeah. So this is how I know the answer.
The violence in it and the violence going on in the home.
That resonated for you.
It broke me. And at the same time, we had gone from a mainstream religion into one that was scary and world ending.
So when you say we.
Mm-hmm. My family.
Your family of origin. Mm-hmm. So this entity of mm-hmm. siblings and parents that mm-hmm. all live together mm-hmm. in a very kind of high style mm-hmm. Southern California mm-hmm. existence. Mm-hmm. You left what you consider
just easygoing, you know.
And you entered some cult-like existence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And
but at 8 years old, what did that
Well, what that feel looked like was, you know, the world was going to start raining fireballs and everybody was going to die but us, and we had to head to the hills with backpacks, and it was going to be really scary.
Oh, man.
So between that.
Pre-Y2K.
Hello. And being pulled away from everything normal. I mean, no more friendships with anybody. You're really pulled away from everybody into this new abnormal, which scared the heck out of me.
Because they didn't believe like y'all believed.
Right. And you had to leave your base of friends and everybody and just go with this group of people, and you're now with them, and you have to, you know, stay away from everybody else, and You know, that sort of thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
And at 8 years old, then you and your twin had this very same experience.
Right. Right.
But you experienced it very differently.
Yeah, because she was very, I'm so blessed that she was very emotionally strong, and she protected me and she hid me. So she knew immediately that something
from
the terror that I felt in the situations, because we grew up in a family that if you cried, you'd have something to cry about. Like, you'd get in trouble for crying, for showing any emotion. And so, like, on my really bad days where crying, there wasn't an option, where I just could not even handle that day, she would hide me, like, in the bathroom and be me for the day.
Physically hide you in the bathroom.
Oh, yeah.
And then go out into the world.
Oh, yeah.
In the as house. Laura.
Oh, because they couldn't. I mean, you couldn't tell us apart. No, it was awesome. Oh, like, she would go to the dentist.
Dang.
She would go to the dentist
for me. I had
all
these sisters, but none of them looked
out so much. And the dentist would be like, wait a minute, we just had this twin here. No. But so she would.
The ultimate coup.
Yeah. So, and I mean, she even took tests for me in school. Like, because when you are that stressed out as a kid, you go into massive disconnect. And I was always nervous. I was always scared, because you always are in trouble, or you're going to get in trouble, or you never know when the situation in the room is going to change.
Yeah.
Or you never know when it's going to get violent or hit. Or
so expectations.
Oh my God.
All
it was
over.
So scary.
You couldn't plan ahead.
Right.
You couldn't
right.
know who you had to be in any moment.
Right. So I got the reputation of being like the train wreck. And, you know, I had a nickname of Inside Out and Backwards, because I was so disconnected.
By who? Your peers?
No, my family.
Oh, dear.
And because I would come out and my clothes would be on completely backwards, and I wouldn't even know it. Like, tag in the front. I still do it sometimes. And my husband would be like, honey, your tag's in the front.
You're like, I'm having an inner child 8 year old.
Yeah, totally.
Just leave me be.
Yeah. And,
but that was because, like, the word you used, I think, is really profound.
Mm-hmm.
Disconnected. So you needed to disconnect from some form of reality because it was so painful.
Right.
So what did you do instead, besides hiding and mm-hmm. having your twin? Like, because I know this has played out mm-hmm. over the course of time.
Right.
And I want our listeners to really wrap their brains and their listening ears around this story,
mm-hmm.
because Laura is not, unfortunately, I don't think she's alone.
No. I'm very textbook. If you look at a child who is hit on a regular basis, especially a little girl, and terrorized, and, you know, child of an alcoholic, it's very normal what I experienced.
So, and let's clarify, mm-hmm. When you say child of an alcoholic, mm-hmm. what does that look like?
That looks like, you know, they call it maybe Dr. Jekyll, Jekyll and Hyde, where it's a personality split, one day happy, next day angry,
mm-hmm.
Emotionally out of control,
mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of thing. And, you know, people react to it differently. It was just massive anger issues in the household. And
so you were this little girl,
mm-hmm.
and you never knew kind of what persona,
mm-hmm.
you knew who was coming home, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mom and dad always came home.
Oh yeah.
But they could come home in different versions of themselves.
Absolutely.
And
yeah. And so
so that was fine.
No. So what happened is how my body internalized it is all of a sudden I developed this great fear that my body was going to forget how to breathe. Like I was so scared. I just begged my body, please don't forget how to breathe. Please don't forget how to breathe. And that became a huge obsession. And then I knew something was wrong with me. I knew something. And I would beg my mother, please take me to the doctor. And they'd take me to the doctor. And the doctor like, there's nothing wrong with you. So then I was the hypochondriac, the train wreck. You know what I mean?
They took you to a medical doctor.
Yeah. And they'd be like, what's wrong with her?
When did you first encounter someone who could put a finger on what was going on with you and maybe asked you the question I ask you, what happened to you, instead of what the F is wrong with you?
30s.
What?
Well, yeah.
Were there breaks between 8 and 30s, or was the rest of it kind of sealed? Oh,
multiple breaks. And the coping mechanisms, of course, as you get older, they get worse.
What does that look like?
Well, as a child...
What does that look like? Because I know several.
Yeah.
I've heard the story.
Yeah.
And for some,
yeah,
coping mechanism is workaholism, which our society welcomes and celebrates and gives rewards to, and they become the, you know, the CEOs and the multimillionaires and all that, because somehow American society supports that ism. But then there's other isms that aren't so okay.
Right.
And what were your isms?
Well, you know, it's so interesting because as a little girl, I became an avid reader. And I got lost in reading.
I knew I liked her.
And so, like, I would go to my grandma's house. My grandma was, like, my early advocate. I would just go to her house. And so, like, one summer, I was, like, 8 or 9, she had Reader's Digest books. And so in a Reader's Digest book, for those of you that don't know, they would have, like, 8 stories in a book. Mm-hmm. So she had, like, 100 of these. And I read all of them in
one
summer.
I'm just going to go away and have a moment with my 8-year-old self, too.
There we go. And I read all of them.
Carry on.
I read all of them. And and that carried me for a while. And I mean, I would get so engrossed where you'd have to shake me to get my attention.
So what do we call that? Readerism?
I would call that early addiction, you know,
okay,
because I became so lost in it. And it was just so...
Because it disconnected you from the world at hand.
Yes.
And allowed you to be present in a whole other world where none of these people were yelling at you and the expectations weren't there.
Right.
And you could put on another...
Right.
I don't want to tell your story.
No, absolutely. And then, you know what, from there, because I have always been... And really, I've never been alone. But I was told I would always need someone to take care of me because I was so broken. Yeah. And so I went from my identical twin to my current husband. I'm married 36 years, but I actually met him at 15.
You know he replaced your twin?
Yeah, he does.
Okay.
Poor guy. I stole his beer at a party. And I'm like an octopus. I'm like... And, you know, never let him go. He's just a really good guy.
So speaking of lucky. Beer, let's go there because I know you... proclaim that alcoholism was one of your major coping mechanisms.
Right.
And
drinking was okay in my family. I mean, I had my first drink at 13.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
was it good for you?
Oh my God. It was everything for me. Absolutely. Uh-huh. And, you know, used to sneak my mom's glue in my milk. I mean, it was awesome. You know, I mean, that was yum. But also, that's also when the mental health crisis, I mean, didn't go away. I mean, it didn't get better. My funerals and the eating disorders started.
Whoa. We just went from Kahlua to like killing yourself. Like, okay.
Right. Well, as a child, you don't understand.
But... Right. And I think that's the reality of our conversation today. I should give a little shout out if there's children listening or parents that have children listening. Just take notes. I mean, it's LA Talk Radio, so we can say whatever we want. And this is the real deal, right? Mm-hmm. This is the real shit. Like, this is what happens when we struggle with chronic trauma.
Right.
Which we now know these things that happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
Have this profound deleterious effect on our mental well-being.
Right.
But until we wake up and realize that's what's happening, we survive the best we can.
Yeah.
But there's, I don't know about you. I've had the dances with the devil.
Oh yeah.
Where, let's, it'd be a lot easier if tomorrow just wasn't on the calendar.
Right. And, you know, I think too, as, you know, a child romancing that, you just don't understand what a permanent way out that is. You just don't. And, what I know now with mental illness is that the different types that there are, that there's like a 25% risk with the majority that can end that way.
But it didn't for you.
So
somehow, so it was your 30s, you said, before someone really offered you a compassionate hand towards mental health.
Yeah.
And before that, though, you'd had multiple
breaks.
Iterations. Okay, breaks.
Absolutely.
What'd that look like?
That looked like the same thing that happened at 8, where I'd be walking across the room and I would feel just a complete shutdown of the nervous system, where my skin would hurt, my chest would hurt, and I would have no functioning central nervous system. And, you know, you and I talked about that, where people do not understand what that feels like, but it's like, you know, where if someone almost gets in a car accident and they have that rush of adrenaline. Mm-hmm. So what would happen was I would have so many adrenaline surges that I would just check out from reality. I would hide. I would hide under covers. You know, my family would call it like blanket heaven. I would just hate to wake up in the morning. I couldn't wait to go to bed at night. I did everything just to function and cope. And I knew I was so good. We were taught how to just put on a pretty face and show up. So I knew how to do that. I mean, I still know how to do that today.
We do. Look at us.
Yay.
We look good. She did my makeup. So
yay.
Shout out.
You know, and that's why I love being an advocate now, because I think, you know, I know for sure what's happening with mental health with women, you know, in our country. And I know that my story is so not
unusual.
So many different. It's such a usual story.
Uh-huh.
And I know I'm very textbook for, you know, for what happened. And I so understand what's happening with mental health with teenagers and you know, things going on right
now. I do,
now.
Laura, but may I just say, you may have an understanding of how textbook mm-hmm. you are because of what you know happened to you mm-hmm. and the resulting crisis mm-hmm. that present in your body in all the different ways, body scan, mm-hmm. the amygdala response with the freeze, flight, mm-hmm. you know, fight response. But I think you are quite unusual in your willingness to share the depths of this story with mm-hmm. my audience today, mm-hmm. with me. Laura shares with NAMI, the National Alliance of Mental Illness, regularly mm-hmm. as a support person. But these are the conversations that I think we dance around mm-hmm. a lot. Thankfully, many celebrities and world leaders mm-hmm. have helped to destigmatize the issue.
Mm-hmm.
The issue.
Yeah.
But the stories are not destigmatized.
Right.
I still feel like when I am in a panic attack, mm-hmm. which happens once in a while, I don't welcome it, don't want it. Mm-hmm. I know there are contributing factors that I have choices in, but mm-hmm. sometimes they still happen.
Right.
On my best efforts.
Yeah.
And I face, you know, judgment mm-hmm. and what is wrong with you? What didn't you do? What medicine did you not take?
Right.
What, you know, like I can't help it that yeah. when I walk into some shit storms of existence
right.
or presence of certain types of personas mm-hmm. that some of that baggage that yeah. I've worked my ass off
yeah.
to heal still shows up.
Oh my gosh.
And the body bears the burden, right?
Absolutely. And you know, I will think I'm handling this well, and then my eye will start to twitch. And, you know, the
ear
will
bow.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, after the drinking, you know, my husband was a beautiful relief, an amazing boyfriend. But, you know, the eating disorder started. It went from anorexia to bulimia. And I was so mad at myself because I thought, you are too lazy to be an anorexic, so now you're going to be a bulimic. You know what I mean? I was so mad at myself that I didn't have the discipline anymore
and
to starve myself.
And there's the shame.
Oh, my God.
I mean, now we're shaming yourself for not picking the right dysfunction.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the PTSD was so bad. I would take people's sentences and just get lost into counting them on my fingers. I would break down the words until I could get them to 30. It's so weird what I would do.
Oh, I totally get that. In my first major panic mm-hmm. Attack as an adult,
mm-hmm.
I had a beautiful friend at the time that did some Googling. Because, mm-hmm. you know, Google has all the answers. Mm-hmm. And Google said, count backwards from 100 by threes. Well, I have a mathematical mind. I love statistics. Mm-hmm. And that was just boring as hell. And mm-hmm. it did not get me out of panic. So to challenge me, he suggested I count backwards by pi, 3.14. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And by the time I got to, I don't know what it was, 62.6329, like I was calm. Mm-hmm. And so I think the point that you're making and I'm trying to iterate for our audience is that every presentation of struggle is unique to the person who's facing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why there is not a blanket.
Right.
Like, that's why it's easier to, when someone says, how are you?
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we're not going there.
No, absolutely. And also, too, we're afraid people can't handle the answer. And, you know, especially with mental health, because there's so much.
Because people can't handle the answer.
No, and there's so much judgment around the real answer, especially when mental health's involved. Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting because we still had a lot of bad, you know, bad stuff going down in the house, even as a teenager. And, you know, my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, you know, that's one of the reasons we got married so young, was he wanted to take me out of that. And, you know, I was so incredibly blessed because he also joined my religion and then pulled me out of it. And we didn't, you know, raise our children that way. And, you know, so we talked about normal lives, but they didn't have to do all the, you know, all the stuff that I did and you know, be pulled from their peers, because I was already feeling so bad about myself and really developed a very deep sense of self-hatred. I took such risks with my life. And like, I used to drive as fast as I could. Sorry if I endangered anybody in traffic, but I wouldn't have a seatbelt on. I would think about jumping out in front of semis. I mean, I just didn't think straight for so many years. I felt like I was, you know, with the life insurance worth more dead than alive.
Our brains tell us all the reasons why this is a good choice.
Right.
The back part of our brain.
Yeah, it didn't have functioning chemicals, you know, and.
But you didn't know that.
Right.
So how are you still here?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And, you know, it was funny because. We were talking a little bit about spirituality.
You and I.
Yeah.
Before the show. I always talk.
Yes.
I don't think John Cole.
Right. And, you know, I believe, you know, and I'm so blessed too that I think this is everything with the 12-step program that I jumped into in my 30s because I was, you know, killing myself with alcohol, which is, I believe, genetic and passed down, and it's nature and nurture. And, you know, my pop, God love him, his dad, same way. And he was pretty beat up also. And, you know, did the best he could. I completely believe that now. And we had a great relationship. He passed 10 years ago this year. And that was all worked out when he passed. And, you know, he had his existence was pretty hard. And so, you know, that was what it was. And, you know, I've been able to work through that. But it was a bitch, man. It was a bitch. And so, you know, Emerson, oh my God, the poet, he was so profound. He used to say that the universe is constantly conspiring for our highest and best good. So I just had angels and people, you know, put in my way. I mean, the first person that fought really hard for me was my twin. Shocking. At 28.
Well, who understood you better?
Right. At 28, she's like, you're killing yourself with your eating disorders and you're drinking yourself to death. Her first bribe was, I will buy you any designer purse of your choice.
So she trumped the one with another. So she found a new addiction for you.
Yes. I'll buy you any designer purse if you want, if you'll stop drinking.
Did she come across judgy? Like there was something there that you received from her?
No, she actually got me to the doctors, and she had a really good psychologist herself at the time. Uh-huh. She had a traumatic brain injury at 18. So she had been seeing, she didn't develop any of the anxiety or depression that I had developed super young until her 40s. So she had a traumatic brain injury and had a really good psychiatrist and got me, you know, into her doctor. And they were able to prescribe something to me. But when that happened, when we were able to get the eating disorder under control, that's when the drinking really took off.
So I'm so I don't know how to say this because I don't feel like I know you well enough to say I'm so proud of you for sharing.
That's okay.
I mean, I know how difficult it mm-hmm. is to bear your story this way, mm-hmm. particularly for an audience that's listening,
right.
That we don't know most right. of them. So thank you for that bravery. Mm-hmm. I imagine, though, these are kind of external factors to mm-hmm. your story, but inside of you, there's something that's going on this whole time that
right.
keeps you alive. So, I mean, I remember the first time somebody kind of laid their hands on my shoulder mm-hmm. and they'd read something I had written. Mm-hmm. And for the first time in my existence, they said, "Lisa, I believe in you." Mm-hmm. And what I took that to mean was that something, some gift in me, some talent in me
right.
resonated and was worth staying alive for and
right.
continuing to work at. So
right.
it's some form of like, you know, external thing.
Right.
But when I would look in the mirror mm-hmm. at the end of the day, I didn't believe in me.
Right.
And it took
absolutely.
Me decades
absolutely.
Since.
So what's missing is when we got married, I had a son at 21 and a daughter at 23. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I had no parenting skills, but
you did. You knew how to beat them.
Right.
You knew how to yell at them.
Well,
you knew how to drink.
Yeah. So in the house, there was no screaming allowed. There was no name calling allowed. But I absolutely did not know. I knew how I didn't want to parent. So we didn't have computers, didn't have phones, we didn't have internet. So I used to go to like Barnes & Noble and I'd go to like the parenting section, pull down books and read them. And what I found mm-hmm. out was, what you and I were talking about earlier is how you look at a child and how you interact with a child from 0 to 5 is how they'll form how the society feels about them mm-hmm. and how life looks at them and how they'll react to life. So I learned to look in their eyes and tell them, you know, let them know how much they were loved all the time. And, you know, they probably thought I was crazy because I was like, oh, you're so wonderful, you know, and especially with my daughter, you know, who is just such a successor. I'm so proud of all my children and my daughter, you know.
But you went to books and schooled yourself
yes.
in what you knew you didn't know.
Yes.
And then you tried it on for size.
Oh my God, absolutely.
Like that, to me, that's incredible. Like you rewrote the story in your genealogy.
Yeah.
You stopped a generational curse by educating yourself and then taking the brave stance. Because my guess is, I'm just guessing here, mm-hmm. this is not something we talked about earlier, and correct me, please, this is your mm-hmm. story. But my guess is that you weren't always feeling the looking in the eyes, loving on your daughter's
no.
side. You still had your demons on your shoulders that
absolutely.
Were telling you, what the fuck are you doing? Like, that's not
oh my gosh,
difference.
Absolutely.
Your daughter's going to be an alcoholic and a blah, 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 too. Like, the noise.
Well, you know, no, the noise was if they ever find out who you really are.
Ah.
You know.
So you were fraudulent in some way.
Yeah. Like.
Or that's what the noise was.
Like, you've got to be enough for these. You've got to be enough for these children. They deserve the world, Laura. You've got to show up for these children.
I sure hope her children are listening.
That's oh my gosh. So anyways, I didn't even know really how to hug my daughter. I was so scared of that relationship. She taught me how to hug, you know, and how to love. And she's so beautiful. And she's so beautiful from inside out. But we were talking about the help, because kind of what the maid did to that little girl, mm-hmm. I did to her, like, every day. Like, you're enough, you're beautiful, you don't need a man's money, you're going to rule the world, you're going to make millions, you know?
Now, Laura, did you do that to her, not just because you read it in a book, but were you cheerleading yourself in the mirror, too? Had you already done your mirror work?
Or no, I did not get into mirror work till 50s.
So for our
being
audience.
Sober, losing sober, getting sober again.
What is mirror work?
Mirror work is where you look in the mirror and you say to yourself, I love you. I really, really love you. You look in your eyes and you sell yourself on you, which is the hardest work you'll ever do. I created something fun. You can learn how to do all of this on YouTube for free with some great coaches. And so I put a fun page on there where they can find the coaches to do this with. But it is the most healing work you'll ever do, but the hardest work you'll ever do. Especially if you are a shame-based person, to get past that shame, to learn to live that authentic life, because there's so much help out there. But
and I have wondered this for a long time until I've done my own work, but why is it that when I look in the mirror and I see myself, the only voices I hear are those of other people? And so, you know, the voices that say, you're not good enough, mm-hmm. you'll never measure up, mm-hmm. you're not worthy, mm-hmm. you ought to be afraid. Don't say that on the radio.
Right.
You're going to offend everybody, which might be true. But, you know, and we have been autonomous, low these, mm-hmm. what, 30-ish years?
Yeah.
And yet those voices from early on, mm-hmm. we have empowered and given a lot of authority in our lives.
Right.
And they've driven a lot of our behaviors. And we didn't know that, right? Because we were so, our bodies were so wonked by all the trauma and just, like they say, what do they say? It takes
a village.
Well, a village. It does. It takes a village. But for me, multiple villages. I've had to leave some because I offended them so greatly. I had to go find other villages.
Yeah.
But y'all are my people.
Move cities.
Right. Geographical cure. Not sure that works. But no, but there are what, 6,000 or 9,000 like negative messages that come into our faces and our brains and our minds and our ears.
70,000.
Like every
it's
day?
Ridiculous.
Every
like
day?
It's so many. Yeah.
And then the amount of positives that mm-hmm. it takes to mm-hmm. override mm-hmm. each one of those mm-hmm. is like three times that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a muscle. And yeah, I mean, that's how I stay alive. I will find you. Oh, Daniel Day-Lewis. Oh, I love that line. It's every day. I meditate, I do breath work, and I listen to positive things every day. That's part of my mental health. And, you know, that's one thing too, is in the writing work that I did in my program when I was getting sober the first time, was it's like, what was your responsibility and what happened to you as a child or in all of this? I'm like, F that noise. What do you mean my responsibility? You know, Well, what I learned as an adult was I still had that hammer or that bat, and I was still beating myself with it. I was still believing those voices that I had heard and that I had internalized, and I still thought I was this nightmare train wreck twin that was broken, and I had to learn new things about myself. I had to do so much writing on that. And I mean, I have that writing hidden.
Are you saying the word writing?
Writing.
W-R-I-T-I-N-G.
Writing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you wrote to override.
Yes.
And you wrote truth.
I had to write how it affected me, what I believed, and new truths about myself. And, you know, when you and I were talking, you know, also in my 30s, that's when Oprah, you know, had all of the wonderful psychologists, and she dedicated so much of her show to helping people, but really women. And so I took the study of those psychologists, more Barnes and Noble sitting on the floor reading books, and really learned from those.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's so funny because I still have patterns that I've had forever. Like my family called me a vampire because I think keep things so dark. And that's a shame cycle where I want things dark.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I wrote about this in last week's blog. Essayist Eliza Tabert mm-hmm. Speaks to this obsession that we as an American culture have with disasters. Mm. And she taps a little bit into some psychology, some trauma, right? Mm-hmm. So who hasn't been traumatized in mm-hmm. some way, but some of those traumas live larger in our being. And so mm-hmm. we are then kind of, we lean into mm-hmm. and obsess over mm-hmm. and want to read about mm-hmm. and whatever. How did your family frame it? Your
dream?
No. I mean, hello. I have a train wreck TED talk, so that will end the TED talk of all TED talks. But no, like that you were obsessed with the dark.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
so
yes, a vampire.
And I don't know how unique that is, mm-hmm. but it to me like that those who accuse vampires of being vampires. I wonder if it's because they just haven't tapped into their own.
Yeah. You know, it's funny too, is I used to hide in tents when I was a kid. We had a big half acre backyard, so I'd go build tents and hide in those. I still, as an adult, will hide under and create a tent.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah, I want a yurt. I need a big tent.
Oh my God, I love yurts.
I want a yurt. I want to sit in the middle with a goat. I want to do like,
You and I need to go find a yurt.
Yes, we need yurt sisters.
I want a yurt. But no, you know what? Because of my scrapes on the dark side.
Beautifully phrased. Thank you for that.
Yes. Yeah. Especially when I wasn't sober and with the combination of mental health and alcoholism, I have had some attempts of doing some really stupid shit.
Stupid by who's?
By anybody that wants to stay alive.
Okay. All right. So you've taken a walk on the edge.
Yeah.
So, a few edges. Lots of
and
edges.
When I
over
drink.
The edges.
Yeah. And for anybody, there's no blackout means that you're still functioning, but you're not thinking. You're out of it. And
so like you get home and you wonder how you got there.
Yeah.
You wake up the next morning and not sure.
You don't know what happened. Right.
Yeah.
So what that taught me is that I'm here for a purpose, and a purpose means that you've been through something tough and now you're here to help other people. So I consider it the honor of my life to help anybody with my story. And that's why I got involved with NAMI, the National Alliance of Mental Illness. Yeah. Is to advocate for mental health in women, because no one talks about it because it's considered shameful and such an embarrassment, where it's just like, if your kidney is bad,
it's life,
especially right now.
Well, yes, and forever. Like, I mean, I don't want to harp against any other population,
right,
particularly men. I love men, but like, oppression of women has been like,
we run the world. There's more responsibility on us than men. I mean, come on now.
But the conversation you and I are having today, I don't feel like is a normal. It's not a normalized conversation.
Right.
And I feel like it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to wrap up here in a moment. I had a friend check in with me. God bless these people that from afar and close check in with us. So something in their experience, they're trauma informed.
Mm-hmm.
They know that something's happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't relegate us off to the professionals.
Mm-hmm.
They stay involved in our lives.
Right.
They check in.
Yeah.
And you and I now have that for one another. Mm-hmm. And we have that.
Our amen corners.
Yes.
That's right.
And I have a friend that checked in with me a couple weeks ago and said, you know what, how are you? And I'm like, I'm in a funk.
Mm.
And like, that's my 4-letter F word.
Yeah.
Fucked up, neurotic, and kick ass.
Awesome.
Because I recognize it. Mm-hmm. I recognize that things are not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something not right in here.
Right. Yeah.
And it's not okay with me.
Yeah.
But I'm okay being in the funk. And
yeah,
his response to me was, Lisa, funk it out.
Ha! There you go.
And I was like, yes!
Yeah.
Funk it out.
Yeah.
Like, be where you are.
Yeah.
But, you know, find your way out of that.
Yeah.
However, whatever that looks like for you.
Yeah.
And for you, you've got your AA, your amen corner, your husband, and these places. But there
absolutely
are times, like, it has to be okay.
Yeah.
For us to
not be okay.
Not be okay.
That's right. And, you know, it has to be okay that this is a normal part of life. Because you and I were talking about what is normal. Well, this is normal for us.
Yep.
And I was telling you that I only want girlfriends that have had at least 3 major mental health breakdowns.
Yeah, I don't use the word crazy because I don't like how it's used.
Mm-mm.
But I do will say you always have to have 4 crazy friends in your back pocket on your phone because they will save your life.
That's
right.
On me.
Well, Laura, God, I mean, I feel like this show should be 3 hours
today. Oh my
and
gosh.
That's the goal. I will be posting some of Laura's best advocacy.
Free.
Free help on the website. My website, as well as the Wine on the Vine Facebook page, where you can also see the show after we close it out here. I want to brag about next week's show quickly. Next week's blog, working title is Pregnant pauses and poignant causes. I have landed an interview with the Ken Schneck from Cleveland, Ohio. And while most of you on the West Coast may not know his name, you ought to. And boy, do we have a story for you. So I look forward to seeing you all next week. And Laura, I honor you.
I honor you.
Thank you for your story.
Thank you for letting me share.
I'll kick it back to the studio now. Thank you, LA Talk Radio.
Take care of yourselves. Reach out if you need help.
That's the truth.
You're listening to Wine on the Vine with Lisa Mayaka, only on LA Talk Radio.